Welcome back to Earth Station Trek, a podcast where we talk about Star Trek from the early days on NBC to the future on Paramount Plus and everything in between. I'm Charles Kelso, and it's my privilege to introduce my fellow hosts, Keith Johnson.
Heyo!
Alan Seiler.
How's it going?
And Veronica Daschle.
Whoa! I don't know why I said whoa. I was trying to say something amusing, and that's what came out.
I mean, it amused us.
That's the important part.
I love it.
All right. And today we're taking a little walk down memory lane, sharing some of our favorite memories of our experiences with Star Trek. You guys ready to get started?
Oh, wait, we're going to talk about Star Trek? I'm always ready for that.
All right. Well, to kick us off, who thinks they have the oldest Star Trek memory?
I'm certain that I don't.
Okay.
Keith?
Oh, me?
Okay, look, I was born in 85. Like, come on. Yeah.
Well, okay. Yeah. Mine is 82.
Okay.
82? Really?
Yeah.
Mine?
I know, right?
Mine is 1971.
Oh,
well, we have a winner. All right, Keith, what were you doing in 1971?
1971, I was still a kid. I think I was in elementary school by then. Yeah, I might have been in first or second grade, I think, something like that. And, you know, we talk about Star Trek. One of the questions people always ask is, when's the first time you saw Star Trek, or what got you into Star Trek? Star Trek is one of those shows where I don't remember not watching Star Trek.
Right.
Because I have two older brothers who got me into science fiction, and it was always on. And one of the things about Star Trek is I sometimes feel sorry for younger people who were born after the ages of cable and internet and streaming and recording devices. Because when I was growing up, shows like Star Trek were on all the time. And even though it's cool, you can look at it now, you can get it on streaming. That's fine. But you still kind of have to make an effort to go watch it when it's on streaming. And it's not something you'll always just choose every every minute of every day. But when I was growing up, Star Trek was on the local channel all the time. So I don't remember ever watching it for the first time. It's always been part of the fabric of my being. But I think I touched on this in our first podcast. One of my greatest memories was, and to this day, I don't know what this was about, but for some reason, there were five episodes that had not been shown in Fort Worth, Texas for several years. I don't know why. Those episodes were the Cage? I always forget which is the one, the two-parter with Spock, the one that was called
The Menagerie.
It was The Menagerie, Where No Man Has Gone Before, Cat's Paw, Wolf in the Fold, and The Lights of Xatar.
Okay.
And I don't know why, but those shows hadn't been shown for like 10 years in Dallas-Fort Worth. And so they had a Star Trek week one year. And they kept local station broadcasting it and broadcasting, oh, Star Trek Week is coming, and Star Trek Week is coming, and Star Trek Week is coming. And so for this one year, this one week, they showed all those episodes. And I was, again, probably 7, 8 years old. And even though I've been watching Star Trek my whole life up until then, I saw The Menagerie for the first time. And I had never seen The Cage either. So on a Monday evening, I sat there and I watched The Cage and The Menagerie, and it was just amazing. Having grown up on Lost in Space and War of the Worlds and The Day the Earth Stood Still and all those kind of Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon, what we now call retro look was just amazing to me. I loved everything about it. The uniforms they had with the jackets, which they brought back for the Enterprise series, I thought was cool.
Right.
I love the round laser guns with the sights on it. I love the fact that they had to transfer a ship's power down to the laser weapon to try to blast through the Talosians. I liked everything about that episode. And if you look at the original series versus the other ones, I think that the first half of the first season is probably the best Star Trek ever.
Yes.
Everything from Conscious of the King to the Corbinite Maneuver to What a Little Girl's Made Of to Dagger of the Mind. And the music was different. Some of the writing was better. You could tell Gene Roddenberry was a TV writer. You could tell that you had science fiction writers like Robert Bloch. And everything about it, the look of it, the colors, the sound, I had by that time been watching Star Trek for probably 5 years, seriously. And it was like, it was a new experience for me seeing that episode. And then followed by Where No Man Has Gone Before with Gary Mitchell. I'd never seen that before. So that was magical to me. All the stuff was completely new to me. And then you go on to Wolf in the Fold, which was good. I actually enjoy that quite a bit. The License Atar, which is actually one of my least favorites, but it was still not bad. And Cat's Paw, which some people dog Cat's Paw, but I really like it. And
it's my favorite.
I know, I remember you saying that last podcast. And the thing is, it's so funny, even after all these years, even though I've seen those shows dozens of times, when I watch any one of those five episodes, it feels magical to me. It still feels special. I remember Star Trek Week, and it's almost like that was my introduction to Star Trek, even though it wasn't. And I just will always have a soft place in my heart for those original episodes. The look and the feel and the sound, everything about those episodes, that's actually more Trek to me than anything else. And also those early episodes, I will contend this the rest of my life. William Shatner gets bagged on so much for being an overdramatic actor. But if you watch that first half of that first season, that man's a phenomenal actor.
Yes.
And it's shown nowhere else like it is in the first half of the first season. So it was also that series that maybe that week that made me think, this man is a great actor. It's unfortunate he later gets reduced to yelling con and the crazy speeches, but that Star Trek is kind of still my Star Trek, and that Shatner, that Kirk, is still kind of my Kirk. So that's kind of my memory of watching Star Trek. Like, I saw it for the first time again because of that Star Trek week when I was a kid.
Wow. Yeah. And you're right. That first half of season one, when Gene Roddenberry was running it, they had the money and time to do the more interesting camera angles, the cinematography, the writing. And then, when it was new, before they started, feeling the time crunch and feeling the money crunch and having to, steal a little here, steal a little there. But yeah, that first half of that first season just feels distinct from the rest of the show.
Absolutely. Just amazing.
Okay. So Alan, you said that your earliest Star Trek memory goes to 1982.
Well, okay. To clarify, that's kind of when I became a serious Trekker.
Okay.
I have memories dating back before that, but I grew up in the 60s and 70s. And I just was not a Star Trek kid, even though I loved science fiction and monster movies and all the movies that Keith mentioned. I grew up on that stuff. I was a Lost in Space kid.
Same here.
I think it may be the lack of a Will and Penny kind of character on Star Trek, because they were basically the same age as me. Billy Mumy and I were the same age. And so he's off doing these amazing space adventures, which is something that I wanted to do. And he's living that. Of course, he's living it in a television studio. And I had no clue about that stuff. But I just didn't see anything in Trek that really grabbed me. So it was in 1982. I had friends who they wanted to go see Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And I was like, okay, well, have fun. They're like, no, come with us. And I'm like, I don't want to go see that. And they're like, no, it's going to be good. It's like super excited. So they dragged me to see this movie, and I'm sitting in this movie, and they did exactly the thing. Well, there's two things that they did that really, really grabbed me. One is that I'm a sucker for any show or franchise or whatever that's been around long enough that it has its own history and builds upon it and references it and that kind of stuff. So this, with the Khan angle, built on an original series episode. So that was like already intrigued me. Then they added Savick, which I'm brand new to Star Trek. She's brand new to Star Trek. So I'm sort of like experiencing the whole thing through her. Like, she's my connection character, right?
I see that.
So these two things, like, I'm really grabbing. But then the special effects were good. The sets were good. The costuming was good. And I was just so into it. By the end of the movie, they're doing the whole, you are now and forever my friend. And Spock is dying in the radiation thing. And I have got, like, tears on my face. And I'm like, I'm not even a Star Trek fan. I am not supposed to be crying at this. What the hell is going on? And I was so sunk by the end of that movie. Like, it had me in its talons. And I have been a big time Trekker ever since. The funny thing is that people now sort of like think of me as the Doctor Who guy, because I like started the Atlanta Doctor Who fan group. I ran a Doctor Who convention for 15 years. I wrote Doctor Who books. I just all kinds of stuff. And I was actually not a Doctor Who fan until 83. So 1 year after Star Trek.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, Alan, you said that you weren't a Star Trek fan. Had you seen enough Star Trek when you went to see that movie, the characters? Not meant anything to you personally, but did you know their histories at all? Were you familiar
with the characters? A little. Like, you know, everybody knew, you know, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy.
Yeah.
You know that.
Right.
And I knew enough about Scotty and Uhura. You know, I knew who they were. Mm-hmm. That's about it.
Wow.
But, you know, I don't know. There was just something... It looked more, well, at least the few episodes that I saw looked more television studio to me than Lost in Space episodes did at that time.
Mm. Interesting.
Go figure. I don't know. It's I don't know. So seeing it translated to like a big movie screen changed everything for me.
That is amazing.
I know. And it just, I was blown away by it.
You said something else I thought was interesting, too, as you mentioned that since you were watching Lost in Space and you had Billy Mumy, you had somebody kind of your age to bring you in. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because one of the things I've noticed about myself growing up is maybe because I have two older brothers who were watching all this stuff, I never was pulled in by kids my own age. So yeah, I'm 7 years old watching Star Trek. And then when I would watch things like, you know, things that had teenagers in it, that actually never pulled me in. Mm-hmm. So, but I think that's an interesting point that it did. And I never thought about Savick's character pulling someone in. That's really cool. That's a great way to come into it.
I loved Savick. And even later on, played by Robin Curtis, loved her. Mm. I wish that they had done more with her. I kept waiting on Next Gen. I kept waiting for an episode where Savick is like an admiral or something. And she's the one who like sends them on a mission and she's a recurring character. And if you remember the two-parter, Gambit, Robin Curtis plays a character. And I thought, this is it. Right. This is Savick. She's undercover.
That's right.
And then at the end of the second half, no Savick. I was so crushed. I'm like, why would you hire Robin Curtis and it not be Savick? Oh, I was so disappointed. But the funny thing, I grew up in a very rural area. I didn't have a lot of friends and I always wanted a brother. I didn't have a brother. So I didn't like have a lot of other like people my age in my life. And I think that's why I really took to Bill Mumy. Mm.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Kind of like you guys, or Star Trek has just always been around. My parents watched Star Trek. I was born in 1980. So by the time I was growing up, you know, it was the original series movies and the show on reruns. Mm-hmm. I was trying to think today, before I became an obsessive fan, what the earliest memory I can date was. And I would put it at, I think it's 87, 88. I would have been in first grade or second grade, depending on what year it was. Next Gen was on TV and I was aware of it. But the memory that sticks out to me is we used to watch Reading Rainbow in class and they'd bring, you know, they'd roll the TV in and play Reading Rainbow. And you know, they did that Reading Rainbow special behind the scenes on Star Trek, The Next Generation. Right. And we were all captivated by that. And, you know, LeVar Burton indicated on it that he plays a character and we were all a bunch of first or second graders. So we were trying to figure out who does he play on the show? Who could he be? Could he be this guy? No, he's not that guy. And then at the end of the episode, you know, he puts his visor on and turns to his station. And like it was a big reveal, which I'm sure if you're an adult watching that, it was not a reveal that LeVar Burton was playing Geordi. But yeah, that's the earliest memory that I could place of Star Trek. And, you know, I'm lucky that it was around when I was born. Next Generation started when I was 6 to 7 years old. And I've basically just rode that wave all the way through into my 20s watching Star Trek. It went, you know, it was a year or two after, well, maybe 2 or 3 years after that, when I was getting more and more into Star Trek, that it really took a turn for me when my uncle let me know that he had the complete VHS set of the original series.
Oh,
and so
great.
I remember I would run downstairs. He had the basement room at my grandmother's house. He would take care of her and those basement rooms were like a Blockbuster video. He had every VHS tape imaginable. And down at the very end of the room on the top two shelves was the original series. I wasn't tall enough yet to reach the top shelf. I had to jump once to knock the tape down and jump again to grab it off the shelf. But I would pretend to be sick so I could go to my grandmother's house, spend the day watching Star Trek. And it just, I must have watched those. I'm sure those tapes don't play now if anyone has them. I wore those tapes out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think as far as being a Star Trek fan, I think I was born a perfect time for it because there was really no drought once I became aware of it until mm-hmm. I was 25. Absolutely. You know, I was
right
from the time I was in kindergarten until I was married. Star Trek was on, you know, every week, which is it's pretty phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
So was your entree the original series or was it actually TNG for you?
Yeah, well, it was the original series movies first, the first things I was aware of. And then okay. Next Gen was current on TV at that time. But once I was, okay. I would say I was probably 10 years old when I found those original series tapes. Mm-hmm. And then I was just watching those every day. You know, I would spend okay. all of my time just watching those 79 episodes over and over and over again. So to this day, that's my favorite TV show of all time. But I sort of followed along Next Gen and Deep Space Nine as they went along. And just I love the 24th century as well.
Yeah.
And the good thing is I was too young when Deep Space Nine and Next Gen were not very good that I didn't care. And by the time I was old enough to know the difference, you know, it was good.
So am I the only one here then whose first love was the original series, watching it from things like your people came in?
Well, mine became that.
Yeah.
I mean, once I caught on, you know, once I saw the movie in the theater in 82, then I went back and you know, sort of like, you know, devoured all those original episodes in reruns. Mm. So yes, it was. And I remember, like, by the time 87 rolled around and TNG was about to launch, I was ready.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet. That's amazing.
Well, I know, Veronica, you came on a little bit later than we did.
Yeah.
You were born in 85. So what was your earliest memory of Star Trek?
My earliest memory is it was playing on my grandma's TV in her room. Not her and my grandpa's room, her room, because they were separate rooms.
That's not all that uncommon.
No, she was born in 24, so that was very common.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I remember it was playing on the TV and then watching it and being like, hey, look, he's from Reading Rainbow. Because when I was growing up, it was basically just Georgia Public Television and PBS. So that was basically my entirety of anything I could watch. Except for until once I turned like 8 or so, I could watch Saturday morning cartoons and like Spider-Man at 2:30 during the week sometimes. So my science fiction was kind of limited to whatever my dad happened to like, which was unfortunately, well, not unfortunately, but it was Star Wars, definitely. So I had the Star Wars versus Star Trek and Star Wars was better mentality for a very long time. I find them equal now because I love them both.
Mm-hmm.
However, there definitely is more Star Trek than Star Wars to love.
Yeah, she didn't mention that when we were dating, fortunately. Yeah.
I knew about Star Trek. I dragged him to his first convention, Dragon Con 2011, and I'd been going regularly since 2003. I'd been on staff there since 2005.
Wow.
I'd been there, but I never really got into it. Because my first track was the costuming track. So I basically never left the track room because I thought it was the coolest thing ever. And then I went to registration and I was like, oh, look, I'm getting all these people happy getting their Dragon Con badge. This is the best thing ever. I didn't go to any panels because I didn't know the shows. I was not aware of Stargate at all whatsoever. Mm. I only recently started Andromeda. But anyway, back to Star Trek.
Yes.
Sorry. Whatever.
Hey, there's connections with Andromeda and Star Trek, of course.
Yes, although Andromeda is only extremely recently. Star Trek. The first year I drug Chuck to there, we were still dating at the time. It was the 2011 Dragon Con, and the DS9 cast was there. I had not seen DS9 at all. He tried to get me to watch it. I had not watched it. I watched TNG with him because I loved TNG. It was my show, even though I hadn't seen most of it, actually. Had a huge crush on Riker.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I love it. That's fair.
I remember when the dealer's room and the Walk of Fame used to be in the same room there and mm-hmm. in that space where they take all the pictures now. I don't know how they fit everyone in there, but I remember walking by in Marina Sirtis and Data. Why am I blanking on his name?
Brent Spiner.
Yes. Brent Spiner, they were sitting there and they were talking with each other and laughing uproariously and we're walking by like, that's them. So that's probably my earliest like Star Trek fan geek memory. But okay. And then going the DS9 panel, I didn't know any of them. So I didn't know who these people were or anything. And wow, I'm really forgetting people's real names. Ezri.
Nicole DeBoer.
Yeah. She was up there talking about stuff. And I'm like, oh, she was a Star Trek fan before she was on Star Trek. That's cool. I should watch her. Mm. And then I didn't get to her for a very long time. And she was in it for a very short amount of time.
Yeah.
And then she replaced the beloved Jadzia. And it was a little heart-wrenching. But that's kind of my Star Trek.
Yeah, if you're watching Deep Space Nine for Nicole DeBoer, you've got a little bit of a wait.
You know, it's funny. I was so funny, and I'm not going to make it about age, but I'm not going to hold y'all's youth against you. It is so funny when y'all say LeVar Burton. I think Kunta Kinte.
Yeah,
absolutely. I don't think Reading Rainbow, because I don't think I've ever watched a single episode of Reading Rainbow. Because as they say, I was good and grown. I was good and grown by the time TNG came. I was in college when TNG was out. So
good and grown.
Yeah. So LeVar Burton is Kunta Kinte. Avery Brooks is Hawk.
Right.
From Spencer for Hire.
Oh, yeah. You know,
That's who I just think of when I think of somebody like that. What's his face? Riker, Jonathan Frakes. He was in one of those used to be incredibly omnipresent TV miniseries, North and South.
Yes. Yep.
He was in that. So that's where I kind of remember him from. Kate Mulgrew is Mrs. Columbo.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or the army officer from Remo Williams movie.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned Roots, because before Voyager started, you know, I loved Roots growing up. And they did a sort of Christmas episode called Roots the Gift.
Yeah.
And before Voyager came on, I mean, I remembered Mulgrew from, you know, she was on one of the soap operas too.
Ryan's
Secret
Hope.
Storm or one of those things.
Ryan's Hope. She's Mary Ryan.
So I'd seen her places, but The Gift was coming on.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, let's just kind of watch and see this new captain that we're going to get. So Mulgrew plays sort of like a bounty hunter kind of lady. Right?
Yes.
Where she's like, yeah. But then I'm watching it and it's got Louis Gossett Jr., of course, and it's got LeVar Burton, and it's got Avery Brooks.
Yes.
And it's got Jerry Hardin, who had played Samuel Clemens. So it's got all these Star Trek people in it. And so that was kind of like a little Star Trek reunion for me. But it was my first time in a long time getting to see Mulgrew, and she was tough in that movie.
She's a fantastic actor.
I love her.
And to the point about LeVar Burton being Kunta Kinte to me, I forget the name of the Star Trek Next Generation episode, but it's the episode where LaForge's mother, ultimately, spoilers for anybody who hasn't seen it, one where LaForge's mother disappears.
Right.
And he's hooked up to that interface, to that probe.
Yeah.
And he's trying to, he thinks he's found her down on that planet. Well, it's funny because the lady who played his mother, Mab Sinclair, was in Roots because she played Kunta Kinte's wife as an adult, the mother of Kizzy, and the guy who played LeVar Burton's father was Ben Vereen, who played Chicken George in Roots. So you had a mini Roots reunion on that episode.
Right.
That's right. I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah.
I was also on The Gift. Also, Tim Russ was in it. It just occurred to me that
Tim Russ
was in it too. So I was watching it for Mulgrew, but then I got our new Vulcan as well, and didn't realize I was going to be seeing him.
See, a lot of these shows you mentioned too, you know, I knew these actors from Star Trek and then went back to watch, you know, Roots and Spencer for Hire and Miss Columbo and things like that because they had Star Trek actors in them. So that's interesting. So let me ask you guys were already Star Trek fans when The Next Generation premiered.
Yeah.
What did you think?
I was super excited. I remember exactly where I was when I watched Encounter at Farpoint.
Okay.
I remember the lead up to it. I sat and watched the whole thing, and it was good. I mean, I was excited because it was new Star Trek, but it was, you know, I mean, you go back and look at it now and you can see that it's kind of clunky.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit awkward. And I think some of that came across at the time, but for me, it was just new Star Trek.
Okay.
You know, we were talking on the previous episode, which might air after our discussion. I don't know. But I was immediately drawn to Troi.
Right.
Even though she's pretty awful in that first episode. you know, it's not until the second one where they stop making her, you know, experience everyone else's pain and sorrow and all that silly.
Great joy and gratitude.
Exactly.
Oh, there you go. You beat me to it. Exactly. And then those horrible echoing, Imazadi, I too could not say goodbye. Oh boy, I couldn't deal with that.
But I thought all the characters were really fascinating. I mean, I was pretty much invested in it immediately.
Yeah, my thought, you know what's funny for me? It was so funny. We talk about this again, because I'm of a certain age. I agree with you. The first season was rough. It's my least favorite of Next Generation, obviously. But I gave them a chance, you know, because you got this Klingon on there. You've got all these people on there. I just wasn't used to them. But you know, my biggest problem with the first few episodes was they were using video effects a lot originally. Remember, like if you think about the phasers and so forth, they were using the kind of video effects. They weren't using the practical effects that they would use in the original series, which they came to later. So if you go back and look at Encounter at Farpoint, look at the phasers. And then look at the phases a few episodes later, they started changing some of the special effects and that kind of video effects. I hate to say it. I looked at them. I'm like, this is like Electro Woman and Dyna Girl. What is this?
Hey, so, it's funny that you mentioned the special effects. I don't know if you'll remember this, but if you watching season one, mm-hmm. as it aired,
mm-hmm. yep.
At the end of each episode, there would be like a little trailer for next week's episode. And a lot of them did not have the special effects in them. Mm. Like, I don't know if the production was that much behind, but I remember specifically Home Soil. Uh-huh. I remember there's a scene at the end of that where they're kind of like on the bridge and, you know, there's like some kind of like electricity mm-hmm. kind of like, mm-hmm. you know, right. And Troy is like, and none of that was in the trailer. Like they're acting to it, but none of the effects are there. And I don't think you'll see that anytime else.
Wow.
You know, I think that anytime that the episode reran after that, it had the right, you know, footage for the trailer.
That is something I didn't know. That, you know, my other thought, this is going to sound, Chuck, this is going to sound really weird. And this is the thing that always comes up for debate. It's kind of like with George Lucas, who some people argue didn't direct some of the best Star Wars. Mm-hmm. One of my thoughts, honestly, and somebody says something about me, one of my thoughts about the first season of Next Generation was, I have to say, frankly, for me, it was too much Roddenberry. As in, I know the essence of Trek, which is the lesson, you know, the morals, meanings, and the messages of Trek. And I got that, and I loved that. But there was so much, it was, in a way, it was more... This is weird. It's more idealistic than the 60s series. And Gene Roddenberry wanted it that way. But maybe because I'm a man of the 20th and 21st centuries, after a while, I started seeing the parables sometimes felt too obvious for me. Mm. And so it was kind of a little bit too obvious with, oh, look at what you did. Kind of like, for example, Q's introduction was really clunky to me. And the whole thing when he would say, you know, you are being charged with being whatever race, it was so...
Right.
In your face, that I had trouble relating to it. And so when they kind of got away from being as obvious about the morals and the meanings and messages, I started liking it more, which is ironic because some of Star Trek that you like the best, as far as I'm concerned, I think if Roddenberry had still been there, I don't think TNG, if he had been in charge, I don't think TNG would have evolved the way it evolved, because he really was more about those morals and those meanings. I remember... there's an episode, I forget the name and I should know the name. There's the episode where the young boy, it's later on in TNG, where the young boy's mother gets killed by basically an alien landmine on a planet.
Yeah.
And then the aliens are non-corporeal and they send that one up to pretend like she's his mother. Well, if you look at that episode, the weird thing is that kid is in his room by himself a lot. And I mean a lot. It's just kind of insane. And mm-hmm. they said that one of the things was, you know, Roddenberry, which we love him for, he was a secular humanist. And Roddenberry really, truly believed that by the 24th century, people would handle death better than we do. And so they said the way Roddenberry thought was, well, why would anybody be in a kid's room all the time? They handle death differently.
Right.
And that's just kind of weird to me. And so sometimes the way he would kind of shoehorn those messages in the first season or two, it was a little clunky for me. And it's kind of like, again, with George Lucas. George Lucas has created an incredible property, but sometimes you have to back away and let other people expand upon what you created. And I think it got better. So my disappointments with the first season of TNG was the special effects were kind of weak, and it just felt so obvious to me with the morals and the messages. And I didn't love it. until, I don't have the numbers right, 110101 on my book, with the Vinars. That's the one that made me love it. Then Contagion, I was like, oh, hell yeah. Now this show's going somewhere.
Yeah, there's definitely a difference to the way Roddenberry approached storytelling in the 60s versus the 80s. Yeah. And I think a lot of that is sort of his guruification in the 70s, where, you know, his a lot of his income was just going around talking about the future and Star Trek and the better humanity at college campuses and things like that. But certainly, you know, you hear things like him being very opposed to there being conflict between the crew members.
And exactly.
The original series didn't have that problem.
Not you at know, all.
You know, yes. The most memorable parts of the original series are conflict between the crew members. But I agree with you. I think it was really when Michael Piller came in season 3 when everything just sort of came together for that show. It sort of turned a corner there.
Absolutely.
Okay, so here's a question for everybody.
Okay.
As new series came along, so whether it be TNG for us old geezers, or as you youngsters, you know, started watching DS9 and Voyager, whatever, what is an episode of those things that hooked you? Like, what's the one where you thought, okay, this is the thing that shows me this is going to be a great show?
You're talking about the new series, or you're talking
from wherever you started?
Okay.
The next new treks
with Voyager, what was that, 95? I'd have been 14 going on 15 when Voyager came out. So really it was sort of like you're bringing together Lost in Space and Star Trek, which were, you know, I was growing up, I was a Sci-Fi Channel kid. So, you know, if mixing those two things together. And then I remember they described Tom Paris in TV Guide as being sort of the Han Solo of Star Trek. which, you know, to me as a nerdy 14-year-old, you start mixing Star Wars, Star Trek, Lost in Space, and it's like, I'm in, you know, you sold.
Yeah.
You know, Deep Space Nine came, I was 11, 12. So, you know, you didn't have to hook me. It was on. So I was watching it. And then with Enterprise, the premise sold me more than the execution did, of being sort of the early steps, you know, sort of the right stuff of Star Trek. And I think that, I don't think they were ever able to fully capture that. I think that they could have gone a lot farther with sort of the early days of making it different from the 24th century, rather than just the 24th century with a new paint job. But also I think that a lot of my experience, it was after Deep Space Nine ended in those last seasons of Voyager when I sort of started falling off the cliff there. But I mean, a lot of that was me. I was, you know, 18, 19, you know, and I'd been, you know, the Dominion War was on when I was 14, 15, 16 years old, which was just perfect age, and just, you know, having my mind blown by Deep Space Nine. And then to me, that sort of late Voyager and Enterprise just felt like sort of the air has been let out of the balloon. You know what I mean? Yeah. While on TV in 2001, you know, 24 was blowing everybody's mind, or just that, you know, grip you in your seat, edge of your seat television. And then just Enterprise just felt slow by comparison, you know?
Yeah, I can see
that. What about you, Veronica?
I was not super into Star Trek until Chuck, and then even then we met late 2010.
Well, it took me a while to get you into Deep Space Nine. It took me several attempts to get you to watch Deep Space Nine.
Oh, that's a tough one.
Well, the trouble with Deep Space Nine is I knew that once you got into it and into the stories and the characters, you'd be hooked because you would love it. But it's a little bit of a rocky road. Like, I promise you, in 60 episodes from now, you will love this character.
Exactly.
Just hang with it. So what finally grabbed you about Deep Space Nine, Veronica?
I genuinely do not remember, but it was probably Worf, because he was a character I was familiar with.
Okay.
And then Quark, because I knew Armin Shimerman from Buffy, not realizing that he was doing Star Trek at the same time when I was watching Buffy when it was live. I guess that was what pulled me into DS9 initially. I still haven't overly gotten into Voyager. I mean, I like it. Ironically enough, I actually like the episodes once Seven of Nine shows up more. Those episodes where Seven of Nine is in it or featured in some way, those tend to be the Voyager episodes. I still haven't gotten into Enterprise. There was a little bit at the very beginning, like he was finally letting me watch it.
Wow.
I don't stop her from watching it.
He's not stop me from watching it. Let's watch DS9.
Yeah,
let's
I refused to let you watch Voyager Enterprise until you like Deep Space Nine. Because I
fair enough.
If you liked Enterprise more than Deep Space Nine, I don't know. We'd have our own separate rooms.
Yes.
That's funny.
For the record, I love Enterprise. Love it.
Same here.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Good. I like the actors in it.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen them in other stuff, especially Archer. He was Scott Bakula is Quantum Leap is amazing. That's not Star Trek. So back to like the first new Star Trek I saw would of course been Discovery, but I was living with Charles during that time. And he was not really a fan.
No,
of
that's not true. I was very enthusiastic about Discovery about halfway through the first season when it sort of took a turn.
Yeah.
But a part of my frustration with that was by that time I was a father of a 12-year-old, and this was the first Star Trek that had been on in her lifetime. And I would have loved to have been able to sit down with my 12-year-old daughter and watch Star Trek the way I watched Star Trek with my parents.
Have they released
but
a season
it
every
was,
year?
You know, TVMA. You have to watch it first to see if someone's going to be disemboweled or naked, you know, there could be a random Klingon sex scene when you're not expecting it. And that was really the point where I sort of threw the remote and I had to be cajoled into coming back to watch it again. Just not that I'm I mean, I watch Game of Thrones and everything else, but
you didn't expect it.
Right. And Star Trek was one of those big influential things from my childhood. And I try to think of who I would be today if I wasn't allowed to watch The Twilight Zone and Star Trek and things like that. If my parents had to say, nope, that's not appropriate for you. You know, that just as a person and creatively, I'd have gone in an entirely different direction without those shows. So it's frustrating to me when Star Trek or The Twilight Zone, to name two specific examples, you know, go the TVMA route, and I don't really see the benefit of doing it. If they were really, if they're really using that to tell great stories, then yeah, I would probably come around. But I think in a lot of cases, you could trim back on the language, the violence, the gore, things like that, and you don't lose anything from the episode.
Right. Right. Agreed.
I do recall that we finally finished season one once they announced Pike. Because that was definitely a big excitement. And I think that was one of the first times I recall you, after we watched that very first Pike episode, you being excited about Star Trek again and having positive things to say about it instead of just ranting about all the
Well, if Captain Pike's coming back, I'm coming back too. You know, I can't let Captain Pike be on screen and me miss it.
Yeah. My main excitement with the new series, like before I had seen it, was the two guys from Rent, Wilson Cruz and
Anthony Rapp.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my main excitement because I loved Rent and I remember watching it entirely too many times when it came out in theaters. And I have a musical theater background, but that was what drew me into that new series initially. I would have watched it anyway. I live with this dork, so but that was something that tickled my fancy, I guess.
Well, what did you guys think when Star Trek came back in 2017 with Discovery and so on?
Alan, you want to go? I've been talking so much.
I was immediately on board, but I will be honest and I will say that the first few episodes of Discovery, mm-hmm. I had a hard time finding Star Trek in them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was so different in tone. It was so different in the way it presented its stories. It was so different, certainly in the sense that it's a serialized story. So, you know, DS9 and Enterprise sort of stepped toward.
Right.
You know,
right.
They were definitely moving toward true serialized storytelling, but I still was having a little struggle. And it's funny because recently, like when season three was starting, I went back and watched the whole first two seasons leading up to it. And I've certainly gotten past that now. Like I can watch those early Discovery episodes and they feel like Star Trek Discovery. They feel Star Trek-y.
Right.
It didn't at first, but I was certainly not going to not watch it. And then it got to the mirror episodes and I thought, okay, this is good stuff. And I'm really digging this. And it was honestly, it was season two with Pike and the other Enterprise crew. And it was, there was a shift in tone that it started to, and I loved the first season, but season two was where it really started, I thought, to click as this is a continuation of all those Star Treks that I used to watch. And the second episode of the second season, New Eden,
right?
They're dealing with this sort of like esoteric sort of, you know, religious slash science debate over whatever this thing is, the Red Angel. And they go down to a planet, they have an away mission, and it felt the most Star Trek-y of everything that I'd seen. It was a phenomenal episode.
A question, and this is always an interesting thing. When you say Star Trek, what does that mean? Do you mean that it taught a moral, a message, or meaning, or that it was exploring? Because there's a couple of aspects, you know, there's so many things exactly. that Star Trek is. Was it that it was a show that had a meaning and a message to teach us about ourselves and human nature, or was it that it was a great science fiction episode that did exploration when you say Star Trek?
It was both of those things.
Okay.
And it was characters that you get invested in, that you grow to love, that you understand and that you connect with.
Right.
And I think I had a hard time connecting with characters in those first few Discovery episodes.
Yeah, I think Anson Mount was definitely a breath of fresh air when he came in.
Oh, God, yes.
It was like, I remember Santa Veronica at the time, it's like a Star Trek character came on the show. You know, he was just very charismatic. He's the sort of character that I would want to go on adventures with for five years, who seemed happy to be there, putting everybody at ease. And I thought that he certainly, like you said, changed the tone of the show a lot. And I remember that episode you're talking about, New Eden, with the little... It's like almost like an original series episode where you get there.
It really, really was.
Yeah, yes. A little Earth town on this planet.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, I loved that.
It was so good. Yes.
So y'all said something very interesting. So do you think the new series Strange New Worlds will be more of a throwback to the original series, the way the Orville is throwback to the original series?
I think it will be. Yes. Okay. For one thing, it's not going to be a serialized show. It's going to be episodic.
Right. Okay.
And that's gonna be a very different presentation, except maybe for Lower Decks. It's gonna be a different presentation than what CBS All Access has done so far.
And I think that now that they've got the sort of revolutionary, edgy Star Trek on the air already, there's not that same pressure. Like they don't have to reinvent the wheel every time now. Like you can do it.
Yeah.
The novelty of the show now is doing a Star Trek show, you know, in the classic sense where you can have characters in brightly colored costumes, unironically going boldly into space.
Singing songs sometimes.
Singing songs.
And they left.
Okay.
It's a short trek.
Oh, you're right. She's talking about the short trek. I was like, I don't know what you watched. Yes, you're right. She did sing a song in that one.
I think for me, since I watched it originally, I knew that, and I have to go all the way back to the original television series, the original series on television, not the movies. I knew Star Trek. And again, I'm probably 7 years old. I'm 6 or 7 years old. I knew that this thing that I was watching was going to be great when I saw Balance of Terror.
Good.
I think that is simply one of the finest episodes of Star Trek ever. And, you know, and I will say this, it's funny, as you guys are talking about, the writing's gotten more mature. I remember when they threw out an F-bomb in Discovery. My God, the internet internet lit up for, I'm not joking, weeks. It went on and on. And Charles, people were saying, like, they're like, I was watching this with my little daughter, and they threw out an F-bomb. And then other people were like, oh, come on, didn't you see it said TVMA, get with the program? But, you know, I will say, as great as the writing has been on TNG and all the episodes, I honestly, after all this time, I still don't think any writing compares on the level of writing great characters. Probably, again, that first half of the first season. You watch the first half of season one of the original series, you can tell Gene Roddenberry was a practiced television writer. You could tell that.
Yeah.
You can see that the people who have been working with Rod Serling were working on Star Trek. Because some of the conversations and the dialogue are just amazing. You know, we were talking last time about you know, the great, when McCoy in that episode is talking to Kirk and he gives him that whole breakdown of how many planets are in the Milky Way galaxy and how many galaxies are in the universe. And he goes on and on and he goes, and all that, and perhaps more, only one of each of us. Don't destroy the one named Kirk. And they, even now, they don't write like that, I think, on that level. And to your point, I'm watching Discovery, and that's what I'm seeing in the first season. It's they don't seem like real people yet. They don't seem like real people like the folks in the original series did. They seem like somebody, I hate to say this because I don't want to come off like the old guy who's not going with the new times. It seems like a lot of people who don't get Trek at its core, writing Trek, playing at Trek. And I also think kind of saying, well, we got to update it for modern times. And I can see a lot of it going on there. So I can see what you're saying about it's going to get better. But for me, the original series, Balance of Terror, it has science fiction with cloaking device. It has action with the battles. It is an, you know, it's a hunter. It's a submarine destroyer. It's a submarine and destroyer. It's an incredible episode and it has great drama. And then when Kirk at the end has to go to the lady who was going to get married in the chapel and basically try to console her because her fiance, who she was just about marrying when the Romans attack, died. That is like a perfect episode to me. Most people say The Doomsday Machine. That's, most people throw that out as the one that is the perfect blend of everything. And I love it. But for me, it was Balance of Terror. And the Next Generation, it was the two episodes with the Bynars. And the reason the Bynar episode, I said, this is going to be a great series. It's the moment when they steal the ship and the action and the music. And the there's a scene where the Enterprise is backing out and the music is just building up to a crescendo and they're getting ready and they're talking about, we got to catch it. And they say too late and it warps out. And every time I watch it, I love the scene. The Enterprise warps out and the music is just amazing. And it's like such a different level than all the other episodes I've seen in the first season. But the music is exciting. And then they do this awesome scene where the camera just starts traveling through the corridor of the Enterprise and it's empty. And it just travels and it changes scenes and it travels and you hear the red alert going and it travels. And the cinematography was amazing. And then they go into the holodeck where Riker and Picard are being entertained by Minuet. And I thought, okay, this is gonna be a good series because that scene is just so well handled. And then Conspiracy, is that the one with those little bug aliens on the back of people's necks? That's a great episode because that's just a great kind of horror, spooky episode. And horrible for me to say, but when they blew that dude's head up, I was like, oh, this is going to be great.
Let's see. Okay. But let's talk about that because that moment is just as gratuitous to a 1987 viewer's eyes as hearing Tilly drop an F-bomb is now.
Yeah. That caused controversy.
I mean, it's exactly, it's moving, it's taking Trek a step forward in ways that maybe a longtime viewer isn't comfortable with.
Right, that's a good point. Oh, I remember in the original series, this wasn't dropped at all. As a matter of fact, I think it's the only time, but Shatner dropped the word hell at the end of City on the Edge of Forever, and that was not done in television. So I didn't watch that in first run. I watched it just a few years after first run, but I guarantee you back in the late 60s, that was probably, people probably went, I can't believe he just did that. But but to your point, there's a point where you probably go too far.
Right.
And I can see that.
Going into the Next Generation movies, there were a couple of, you know, S-bombs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely.
Alfred Woodard, definitely.
And Data.
Exactly.
Oh, that's right.
And so it's, you know, Tilly's F-bomb was definitely a shock when it happened, but it's not so out of context that it's, you know, I mean, it sort of followed a trajectory, maybe not a trajectory it should have gone. I don't know.
That's something I've noticed in particular with season three, every episode is a serialized story, but you've got a little Star Trek episode going on at the same time. You've got the little Star Trek adventure. And then around that, you've got the serialized adventure. And I've been enjoying season three quite a bit.
Definitely.
I think that's to your point. I think what it all boils down to is what is Star Trek? Because I know I've listened to people analyze Trek before, and somebody said one of the ironies is arguably the single most popular episode of Star Trek of all time, sitting on the Age of Forever, is not a Star Trek story.
Right.
And not just because it wasn't written by the Star Trek people, but because it doesn't have a deep moral meaning or message. It's just an incredibly good science fiction story with an emotional hook into it, but it's not traditional Star Trek in the way some of the other episodes are. And I know that I know there were some changes made to it, because I know in the original story written by, why am I blanking on his name?
Harlan Ellison.
Harlan, thank you. I was going to say the most irascible, irritating science fiction writer of all time. I know in the original script as he wrote it, Spock was the one who stopped McCoy and not Kirk. And Roddenberry was saying, no, there's just no way. And Harlan Ellison was extremely upset about that. And I think in the original story, it was actually an Enterprise crew member. Now you'd have this, but I think in the original story, as Ellison wrote it, the guy was a drug addict. Not somebody who inject himself with cordrocaine. But to your point, Alan, nowadays I could see them doing a story with a drug addict on a starship. And I could see Roddenberry turning over in his grave because he would go, that's not the point. That's not what people are supposed to be like in the future. They're not going to be drug addicts.
Right.
Unless it's some kind of weird alien spore or something like right. that gets into them. So I think sometimes, to your point, what happens is people forget what Star Trek is.
We should do a whole episode on what is Star Trek.
I thought that, you know, it's funny as you guys are saying that, I wrote down two things as a good podcast idea. What is the definition of Star Trek? And what would Roddenberry think now? And
to jump off that as well, some of the times when Star Trek has been at its best, it's not been Star Trek. Things like The Wrath of Khan, yes. or First Contact, or The Undiscovered right. Country, and some people could argue Deep Space Nine.
Absolutely.
When Star Trek isn't doing Star Trek, Absolutely. Sometimes it does its best work.
Sometimes.
Right.
Quick spoilers for anybody who hasn't watched these, but actually one thing I was going to post to some Star Trek Facebook groups and be a discussion. To your point there, Charles, is I've always wondered what would Roddenberry have thought about these episodes, which is where these characters did something that he would have died over. Arguably the best episode of Deep Space Nine is in The Pale Moonlight.
Mm-hmm.
And Roddenberry, there's no way he would let that thing happen. There's just no way, because Sisko basically is party to murder. And another one, which is shocking to this day, again, spoilers, Enterprise, where Archer turns into a pirate. Now, you can say this was pre-Federation.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, so I won't say anything else about it. But you can say that was pre-Federation, but Roddenberry would have had a fit with something like that. You know, he would have
the whole point of Enterprise, though, and you think of it in terms of... the Federation being formed and mm-hmm. taking your first steps out into space and all the kind of stuff. But really at the heart of it, the point is it's the road to that Roddenberry vision of what what humanity can achieve mm-hmm. in the future. There's a great episode in the fourth season after the third season is the Zindi attack on Earth.
Right.
And there's a great episode at the beginning of second season called Home, where the Enterprise makes it back to Earth and they find that society has become incredibly non-tolerant and very xenophobic uh-huh. because, I mean, and that's a natural response to being, having your entire state of Florida obliterated by some lizard people from across the galaxy,
right.
you know, and it's a fascinating look at humanity making those steps toward what Roddenberry thought we could achieve down the road.
You know, my feeling about it, and I've felt this before, and I said something once, Star Trek is my favorite science fiction world, bar none. I mean, I love magic and stuff, but if you ask me, would I rather live in a world of Lord of the Rings where I had magical powers, or would I rather live in a Star Wars universe where I could, seems like, cross the entire universe in like 10 seconds? Star Trek.
Well, you can do that with four drives.
Yeah, there you go. Well, good point. To me, Star Trek is the best of all worlds because it shows what we can be. And I've always said this, like when the movie the second...
Into Darkness,
right? I personally do not like the entire the Kelvinverse. I don't care for the Kelvinverse at all. I just think it's a waste of time. However, I remember a lot of people are angry at that movie because they said it was too dark and it had no moral, no message, no meaning. And like we were talking about with shows like City on the Edge of Forever that don't have a moral message or meaning, sometimes I will tell people, and they'll say, it's not Star Trek. I said, well, no, it is Star Trek, because Star Trek is not just a show that says every episode has to have a meaning. Star Trek is a vision where Gene Roddenberry says, if we don't kill each other, we will end up in a universe where we will have these adventures. And not every adventure has to have a moral or a message. To me, even Into Darkness is a Star Trek episode. Into Darkness is still Star Trek. because he's postulating a world where we have survived, where we can have warp drive and live in the future. So I don't need every Star Trek episode to tell me a story or teach me a moral. And I therefore say to a lot of ways, Discovery is Trek, because Roddenberry is saying, if we hold on, we can live to have this world. But to your point, if that's all you do is turn it into pure science fiction, because Star Trek is science fiction, but if all it is science fiction, after a while, it doesn't become Star Trek. And I think that's why I didn't like the first season, Next Generation, because it felt so moralistic with all the lessons. I'm like, okay, I know Star Trek is about a message, but I need a little bit more rousing science fiction. So there's that blend that you have, to me, to make Star Trek. And it sounds like what you guys are saying, Discovery is finally getting to that.
Absolutely. Point. Well, we're definitely going to have to reconvene to discuss what Star Trek is, because we're right at an hour.
Yes.
If anyone listening to this would like to hear more of you, Alan, where can they find you on the internet?
Hey, find me on Facebook and just friend me. I'm a friendly guy. But beyond that, I own a little publishing company and write a bunch of books. And it's called Cosmic Press. It's KOZMICPress.com.
And what about you, Keith?
Right now, just find me on Facebook. I'm on several groups. I'm on the ESO Podcast Network Facebook pages. I have my own Facebook. And just find me on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, but I almost never use it. I'm on Instagram, but I almost never use them, because you might be able to tell I'm not exactly the guy who uses a few words. And so I tend to like long conversations. So I do Facebook.
140 characters just ain't going to work.
No, that's barely saying SOS.
All right, well, Veronica, well, you and I are puppeteers. We operate under the name Felt Nerdy. We do local shows for conventions across the Southeast, or we did when there wasn't a pandemic going on. And then also we sometimes do adult-based stuff here in Atlanta. But do you want to tell people where they can find more of that?
FeltNerdy.com.
Yep. Or on Facebook or Twitter at Felt Nerdy. Or you can hit up either one of us on Facebook. Or I'm also on Twitter at Kelso is dead. But I don't use that as often as I would like.
Oh, I just got it. Yeah. Yep.
And my Facebook is / destruct button, because Kelso is on the destruct button to the last minute.
Awesome.
Thank you for listening to Earth Station Trek. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a positive rating. You can also send us feedback at earthstationtrek@gmail.com. You can join in the fun in our Facebook group or follow us on Twitter. You can also visit us online at earthstationtrek.podbean.com. We'll see you next time. Live long and prosper.